So Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we are reading today from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 7, Chapter 5, Verse 31. It's kind of a famous verse from the prayers of Prahlad Maharaj. So I'll just read it through once and then we can do the call and response, I guess. Na te vidu svarta gatim hi Vishnum. Na te vidu svarta gatim hi Vishnum. Durasaya ye bahir artamanina. Durasya ye bahir artamanina. Durasya ye bahir atarmanina. Andayatanda rupaniyamanas. Andayatanda rupaniyamanas. Te pisa tantram unu damni baraham. Te pisa tantram anu damni baraham. Na te vidu svarta gatim hi Vishnum. Durasaya ye bahir artamaninam. Andayatande rupaniyamanas. Te pisa tantram uru damni baraham. Nate vidu svarta gatim hi Vishnum. Durasaya ye bahir artamanina. Andaya tande rupaniyamanas. Te pisha tantram urudam nibadaham. Na te vidu svarta gatim hi Vishnum. Andaya tande rupaniyamanas. Te pisha tantram urudam nibadaham. Na te vidu svarta gatim hi Vishnum. Durashaya ye bahir artamanina. Andaya tande rupaniyamanas. Te pisha tantram urudam nibadaham. One more, maybe? Ladies. Na te vidu svarta gatim hi Vishnum. Dasya ya ye bahir artamanina. Andaya tande rupaniyamanas. Te pisha tantram urudam nibadaha. Just go to the translation. Yeah. excuse me. So Kalakanta Prabhu informed me that usually we do a group reading of the purport to involve people, but for the sake of saving time and because my lecture is a little bit interactive to begin with, I'm just going to read this through for the glory of the Lord. Persons who are strongly entrapped by the consciousness of enjoying material life and who have therefore accepted as their leader or guru a similar blind man attached to external sense objects cannot understand that the goal of life is to return home back to Godhead and engage in the service of Lord Vishnu. As blind men guided by another blind... Oh my goodness. As blind men guided by another blind man miss the right path and fall into a ditch, material attached men led by another material attached man are bound by the ropes of fruitive labor, which are made of very strong cords, and they continue again and again in materialistic life, suffering the threefold miseries. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Since there must always be a difference of opinion between demons and devotees, Hiranyakashipu, when criticized by his son Prahlad Maharaj, should not have been surprised that Prahlad Maharaj differed from his way of life. Nonetheless, Hiranyakashipu was extremely angry and wanted to rebuke his son for deriding his teacher or spiritual master, who had been born in the Brahmana family of the great Acharya Sukra Acharya. The word Shukra means semen, and Acharya refers to a teacher or guru. Hereditary gurus or spiritual masters have been accepted everywhere since time immemorial, but Prahlad Maharaj declined to accept such a spiritual master, declined to accept such a seminal guru or take instruction from him. An actual guru is Shrotriya, one who has heard or received perfect knowledge through the parampara, the disciplic succession. Therefore, Prahlad Maharaj did not recognize a seminal spiritual master. Such spiritual masters are not at all interested in Vishnu. Indeed, they are hopeful of material success. Bahir Artha Manina. The word Bahi means external, Artha means interest, and Manina means taking very seriously. Generally speaking, practically everyone is unaware of the spiritual world. The knowledge of the materialists is restricted within the 4 billion mile limit of this material world, which is in the dark portion of the creation. They do not know that beyond the material world is the spiritual world. Unless one is a devotee of the Lord, one cannot understand the existence of the spiritual world. Gurus, teachers, who are simply interested in this material world are described in this verse as andha, blind. Such blind men may lead many other blind followers without true knowledge of material conditions, but they are not accepted by devotees like Prahlad Maharaj. Such blind teachers, being interested in the external material world, are always bound by the strong ropes of material nature. Om Angyana Timirandasya Gananjana Shilakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobishtam Shtapitam Yena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadakti Sva Padantikam Vanchakalpaturubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhya Ibacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ram 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 Hare Hare. So, thank you again. How do I get the PowerPoint up on here? Oh, this is like a full-blown computer here. All right, can you make it full screen there on the bottom? The Village of the Damned. All right, so again, thank you for coming. I have not given a Bhagavatam class in English in a long time, so I hope I find the words. I've also never given a Bhagavatam class in a chair, so it's a brave new world here in ISKCON Gainesville.
But somehow you had a picture of our
house. Yes, I did manage to find a picture of the Krishna House inhabitants on the web. So this is, Andy Prabhu asked if I wanted to give a class on Nisringa Lila or on blind faith. And so I picked blind faith in Germany, where I live, in East Germany. Well, now the eastern part of Germany, we have a student sangha group that meets once a month, where the qualification to belong to this group is that you have to be an enrolled student. And so that's me. And once a month, one of these students will present, something having to do with what they're studying in the light of Krishna consciousness. So, I gave a 3-hour seminar entitled Leaps of Faith and Doubt, which says something else in German, but that's beside the point. And so often we hear about taking leaps of faith, you know, but, what I'm going to, demonstrate, or hopefully demonstrate in this, it's not really a PowerPoint, it's more some visual aids to the lecture, is that people also often take leaps of doubt, that often to just you know, there's such thing as blind faith, which is the topic of the lecture, but there's also such thing as blind doubt, which is just people that just want to doubt things, even in the face of like overwhelming evidence to the contrary of what they're saying. So to begin with, I just press this button. Okay, so this is what I used to teach. Ah, okay. I feel like Luke Skywalker now. So this is a, I'm going to show a picture now that I used to show my Rocks for Jocks students here at UF Geology 1000. On the first day of class, when we give them a little introduction to science, I show this cartoon here. And so can somebody please explain to me what's going on in this cartoon? Describe the scene here. Everybody at once. There's a black cat crossing the road. Very good. That could be considered unlucky. The person who made me this cartoon made the cat black. That was not intentional. But that is a good inference. You could consider the cat to be unlucky. So there's a cat crossing the road. Anything else you want to add to this? It's the morning time. Okay, how do you know that? But how do you know which direction the picture is oriented? It could also be the evening time, and you're looking south. Huh? Kind of like the fall. You can see the leaves are changing on the trees. Okay, so you can take a look at this and you can make some observations. And the observations are, you know, somewhat factual in nature. We all agree that there's a cat crossing the road. Okay, so now can somebody tell me, except for Andy, because he's seen this, can somebody please tell me what happened in this picture? What happened in this? What happened? What's going on now? Huh? The cat was run over by the car. Is that what you said? Someone spilled a paint bucket on the road. Okay, I mean, the common answer is that the cat got run over by the car. Yeah? How do you know the cat got run over by the car? Yeah, in the previous picture, there was a cat that was not smashed on the ground. This is overly intelligent for me. I mean, the common thing to think is that the cat got run over the car, but nobody here actually saw the car run over the cat. We're making what's called an inference. You know, we see, okay, there was a cat, you know, walking happily across the road, and then suddenly there's a cat smushed, smashed, crushed on the road, and a car driving by really fast. But although we didn't actually see the car run over the cat, we make this inference. And so that's based on circumstantial evidence. But what kind of things could we do to maybe confirm that the car ran over the cat? You could ask the driver. That's very good. Yeah. You could look for tire marks. Where would you look for tire marks? On the cat. You could also, conversely, you can just... Just warming everybody up for breakfast here. Conversely, you could also look for cat marks on the tires. And so these are all very good answers. And this brings us to the next point, which is, how do we know what we think we know? This is, you know, especially in America, in the Western world, my experience is that people, you know, being knowledgeable, being intelligent, being smart, having knowledge of facts, you know, like you can go on Jeopardy and win thousands and thousands of dollars for knowing trivial facts about things. But is that really knowledge? You know, what do we really know in this world? This is, of course, the study of, in Western philosophical terms, the study of epistemology. And epistemology is basically the understanding of the world based on certain types of evidence. What is the burden of proof? What are we willing to accept as proof of a certain thing? And in Sanskrit, this word is called pramana. Now, pramana means evidence. And there are three basic types of pramana. There's not a lot of words in this PowerPoint, so don't worry. So the Sanskrit word for these evidences are pramana. Excuse me. And there are three types of pramana. There's direct perception, which is what we had when we saw the cat crossing the road. We can all see the cat crossing the road, and we know we're not really hallucinating because everybody in the room basically saw the same thing. Okay, maybe there's a mass hallucination. Like we're all hallucinating Brahmatirtha Prabhu coming in the room now. But there's direct perception. And this is a valid type of evidence. Krishna speaks of this type of evidence in the Bhagavad Gita. He says, pratyaksham vargamam dharmyam, that the truth of him in the 9th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, where he's revealing the most confidential knowledge of the absolute truth, he says that this truth is available to people by direct perception, pratyaksha vargamam dharmyam. But beyond pratyaksha, you missed the dead cat on the road. I'm very disappointed. Anyway. Beyond pratyaksha, there's inference, logic, reason, and argument, which in Sanskrit is called nyaya. And actually, nyaya in Hinduism, does it? It means logic in Sanskrit, doesn't it? Yeah. Okay, I don't know any Hindi. I know a little Sanskrit. but nyaya is also one of the sat darshans in Hinduism. So this is the exercise of logic, reason, and argument is actually a yogic practice to a certain extent. In the Western world, this often relates to logic is a mathematical study, actually. You can take, if you take a logic class at the university, that would be in the math department. There's also rhetoric, debate. And so these are ways that people come to conclusions about things. But this is through inference. This is not direct perception. So, rhetoric I don't know, how would you define rhetoric? It's a mode of speaking. It's a style of engaging in conversation with people in order to prove a point. It's like debate. Or it's a style of speaking. Yeah, that's another definition. Slightly different. There you go. Yeah, or persuasion is the point there. And so this we saw in the second picture, where none of us actually saw the cat getting run over by the car, but we made an inference. We saw, well, the cat is now smashed on the ground and there's a car driving away really fast. And so we infer that the cat got run over by the car, and we can increase the potency of that inference by looking for more evidence, by, looking for tire marks on the cat or cat marks on the tire, et cetera, et cetera. And then there's the last one, which Gauranga Prasad Prabhu very appropriately suggested. There's hearing from an authorized source, which is called Shabda. As devotees, we talk about Shabda Brahman, that there's an authorized source that is on the Brahman platform, that is beyond this material world. And it's from this source that we obtain knowledge of the absolute truth. Or we obtain knowledge of things that are beyond our direct perception in our current conditioned state, and are also defy logic, reason, and argument. It's not that everything in the transcendental world or everything in the absolute truth has to be logical. That is a decidedly Anglican understanding of the absolute truth, actually. So there's Shabda. So we could ask the driver, hey, did you just run over that car? And we would take the driver as an authority, because he's driving the car, and if you hit something with your car, you would know it by direct perception. Oh, what was that? Meow. Anyway, so the point is, so just to move on to the next slide here, the point is that with direct perception and with logic, reason, and argument, we will never actually be able to come to an understanding of what absolute is, of the absolute truth. And as we heard from the purport that we just read, intelligent people, a true guru, a true teacher, someone who really has knowledge, real knowledge, is knowledge that is pertaining to the spiritual world. That is knowledge that is pertaining to a reality that is not contained within this three-dimensional world that we call Earth or the galaxy or the universe or whatever. And so this is another little picture we like to show the geology students to somehow illustrate. Are you sure there's no laser pointer on this thing? There is a laser pointer on this thing. It just doesn't work. Anyway, this is called an asymptote, this graph here. This is, any mathematicians here? What is this the graph of? What is the mathematical function here? This is the graph of the function, y, that's the vertical axis there, equals 1 over x. And so you can see on the horizontal axis where it says truth of the infinitely small, as the x value, which is in the bottom of this fraction, gets bigger, the y value gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. But it will never hit zero. It will just approach zero. And then, conversely, on the y-axis, if x gets smaller and smaller and smaller, if x becomes a fraction or a decimal, a larger and larger decimal, the y value gets smaller and smaller and smaller. But it will never actually hit zero. This is called an asymptote. So this is likened to our sense perception. Our senses are limited, as Prabhupada explained many times. I can see things, I can see you guys, but I also don't have my glasses on, so I can't, for example, see the color of your eyes from back here. You know, just as an example. For another example is, we have an auditory sense, which is very limited. We hear audible frequencies in a certain range of vibration, but a dog, for example, can hear a vibration that is on a much higher frequency. So if we go into a pet store and blow a dog whistle, the humans won't hear it, but the dogs in the store will all start going crazy because it's on a different pitch. So our senses are limited. We can do things to aid our sense perception. We have telescopes. We have microscopes. We have very advanced types of microscopes. I've been using an electron microscope here at the university the last week, which is really like a mystic potency almost, that can create an electron microscope can create a visual image of something that is extremely small. I was magnifying little crystals to 50,000 times their normal magnification. And it does this just by shining a laser on it and detecting how the vibration of the atoms in whatever substance you're looking at changes just by shining a laser on it. So this is not a visual image, but then there's a computer program that interprets the signal from this laser to make a picture on a computer screen. So we can aid our perception. But nonetheless, we can never actually see the absolute truth. And we know Krishna says, for example, in the Brahma Samhita, Andantarashta Paramanu Chayantarashtam. That means that he is larger than this entire universe. You know, so we can't even see to the ends of this universe. Now, every time we think we've seen to the end of this universe, the universe appears to get bigger. And we cannot see the smallest particle. Paramanu Chayantarashtam, Krishna says. That means he's also smaller than the smallest particle. When I was in high school, for example, the atom was the smallest particle that we knew about in science. And it's like, yeah, atom. We found the atom, and we can see the atom, sort of. Can't really see an atom. You can see residual traces of an atom. But now there are even much smaller particles that scientists know about. There are quarks, and there are bosons. And recently, just a couple months ago, scientists found the Higgs boson, which is something that they've been looking for a long time. And these are even much smaller than atoms. And so by inference, we can also understand that, there's probably a particle smaller than the Higgs boson, because every time they find a new particle, it's smaller than the other one. And then Krishna himself is even smaller than that. And so through our sense perception, we can never actually perceive directly the absolute truth like that. So I want you all to keep that in mind. So basically the conclusion here is that what we think we know in this world is largely not based on sense perception. It's largely based on inference, and it's even more so based on hearing from a source that we consider to be bona fide, whether it's a newspaper, a guru, a politician, like they just had this storm and the politicians are saying, get out of town. The governor is telling you to get out of the city because the storm's coming. You might want to accept that as an authority and get out of the city. Anyway, I want to switch topics a little bit and take you on a journey to the geologist's Mecca here. Oh, wrong button. Anybody recognize this place? Yeah. How do I go back? Shabda. Yeah, okay, I guess we don't need to go back. Pratyaksha. Yeah, these are called pramanas, which means evidence. And then there's pratyaksha, which is direct perception. There's nyaya, which is inference, basically, and anything that entails that. And that's right. Anuman. Thank you. Nyaya or anuman. Anuman is inference. Nyaya is logic. Yes. Not through conditioned material senses. Yeah. I'll hold that thought. I'll get to that in a minute. Yeah, thank you. We'll get to that in a minute. Yes, there you can perceive the absolute truth directly with your senses, but not when the senses are materially conditioned. And I will get to that point in a minute. Right now, I want to take you on a little journey. Does anybody recognize this place? Yeah, this is the Grand Canyon. The Grand Canyon is a geological wonder. And is often the center of contention between geologists, regular material geologists, and people who are known as young earth creationists, who are generally Christians, or not generally Christians, they're Christians, basically, who believe that the earth is 6,000 years old. And both of these people, the geologists point to the Grand Canyon as very good, very sound evidence that the earth is very old, and that the processes that we observe on the planet going on today have been going on for billions of years, and that's what creates, you know, landforms as we know them today. The young earth creationists, they look at the Grand Canyon and they see very clear evidence that there was a global flood, you know, and that this happened very recently, and all of this stuff that we see here accumulated very rapidly and then was washed out very rapidly. And this is known in geology as the theory of catastrophism, that that everything that we perceive, landforms and whatnot on the earth, are results of catastrophic events that took place. So we see in the Grand Canyon, the Grand Canyon actually consists of two different canyons. On the bottom, there's the lower canyon. The rock actually at the bottom of the Grand Canyon is named after the Supreme Lord Vishnu. This is called the Vishnu Schist because it's very old and it's very black. And this is a completely separate thing than what's sitting on top of it, which you can see. I put the thing on the left here, so you can see that the lower thing is sharply tilted. It's the rocks are all at an angle like this, and then on top of it are what we call pancake geology. There's all this stuff that's lying flat on top of it. And so the young earth creationists, they say that the stuff on the bottom, this was created during the creation week. They say specifically it was created on the third day of the creation week, because that's when God created the heavens and the earth, I guess. I don't know. I didn't check into the Bible this morning. And then they say that everything is on top of it is a result of the global flood, of the Noah flood. And they have lots of evidence. There are all kinds of fossils in these rocks. There are fossils of deep sea creatures. There are fossils of plants that only grow in like 60 or 70 feet of water. There are fossils of plants that only grow in like 200 or 300 feet of water. And they explain that this flood came through, and, you know, if you can imagine a flood, we've all seen flooding here in Florida. It carries a lot of debris with it. And so this debris settled, and the way that this is pancake like this just has to do with what settled out of the, floodwaters first, you know, is on the bottom, and then what settled out of the floodwaters last is on the top. And they have a very logical, explanation for all this, actually. And if you are predisposed to accepting the idea that the earth is very young and that there was a global flood about 5,000 years ago, this will all make perfect sense to you. And then they say that there was a big lake. After the flood, there was a big lake just north of this area, and whatever was containing the water in that lake washed out and created this another huge deluge that basically washed out the Grand Canyon. And so there is evidence. There is evidence. You can look at the Grand Canyon, you can make some inferences, and you can come to this conclusion. And, you know, there are thousands, if not millions, of people in this country who believe this. Believe it. So, yeah. But it's a belief. They have faith in this. And then there's the regular geologists who look at this and say, there's no way. They can point to the different types of rocks there, where we can see these types of rocks forming on the earth today. We can see where limestone forms. We're sitting on a big limestone package right here. And they can look at this and they can see, no, this rock formed in this environment and it took this long and it's this old, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So who is right? I'm going to now show you something that, so it doesn't really matter who's right. There's a huge hole in the knowledge here which calls both of these models into question. And that is, between the lower canyon and the upper canyon, there's something called the Great Unconformity. An unconformity in geology is a big piece of missing time. So we have the lower, The lowest member of the flatlying stuff is called the Tapiz sandstone, and that's been dated with radioactive dating methods to be about 550 million years old. I'm not going to get into radioactive dating and all of the really interesting assumptions that go into that, but let's just say this is 550 million years old. And then the lower canyon, the Vishnu Schist, is about 1.7, 1.8 billion years old. So between these two rock units, there's 1.1 billion years of history missing. That's a long time. And you could say, well, okay, there's some rocks missing here. But if you look at, this is called the Great Unconformity. And why it's called the Great Unconformity is not only because of the great temporal vacancy, the great time vacancy between the things, but this also has an enormous geographic extent across the United States of America. This same exact unconformity between that sandstone or a contemporary sandstone of the same age and that Vishnu Schist is spread over a land area that I've traced out on this Google Earth map here. And so so the Great Unconformity represents a span of time of about 1.1 billion years, and it covers a geographic extent of about 10 million square kilometers. The kilometers are what people use to measure distance in every country in the world except ours. That's about us. But 10 million square kilometers is about, what does that say, 3.9 million square miles. So that's huge. Just to put that into perspective, the Roman Empire, which was the longest surviving empire on the earth, existed for roughly 2,000 years and covered a geographic extent of about 6.5 million miles. Yeah. So what does that mean? The conclusion here is that you could fit almost a million Roman empires, almost a million Roman empires could have risen and fallen within the spatial temporal area comprised by the Great Unconformity, and there would be absolutely no evidence of any of their existences. Yeah? That's kind of amazing, actually. But yet, and scientists, they look at their evidence, and I think we can all agree that the scientific evidence for the history of the Grand Canyon is much more reasonable than the young Earth creationist evidence. But we see, and so scientists, they have their methods and they can come to these conclusions, but they're leaving out enormous aspects of the whole picture. We're talking a million Roman empires. We, you know, archaeologists or anthropologists look at the Roman Empire, and we use this basically to tell the history of the human race. But a million of these empires could fit just in that one space, which is a pretty localized thing, actually, if you consider the whole globe. Yeah. The point is that we don't really know. There's some evidence, but most of the evidence and most of the area where the evidence is lying is lost to humanity. So my point here with this is that we've developed a worldview based on these scientific principles, and people just have faith in this. You know, practically speaking, nobody's actually ever seen any of this evidence. They've just had the evidence explained to them. You know, but what they haven't had explained to them is the missing evidence and all of the things that go into building this assumption that is just hidden from them. You know, so this is pretty profound stuff. And so what does this mean? This means that it's actually very difficult to know anything in this world. This world is so vast, you know, and we're just on one tiny little planet here. You know, there are billions and trillions of stars even in our own galaxy. You know, and our galaxy is one of billions and trillions of galaxies that exist in this world. So to think that we are going to come to a conclusion of understanding what this world is or where it comes from based on our own sensual endeavors, either through direct sense perception or through the exercise of our mind in the form of inference or whatnot, is really a foolish proposition. And this is why Prabhupada criticized scientists a lot. You know, Prabhupada was not a scientist himself, and he claimed that regularly. You know, he was not hiding that fact. But he was very critical of scientists. If you look in the Veda base, Prabhupada and Prabhupada's books, conversations, lectures, etc., there's about 10,000 references to the word science or some derivative thereof, scientists, you know, scientific, whatever. There's about 10,000 references. It's a lot. In most of these references, Prabhupada was like hammering away on these people. "I'll kick them in the face with boots," he said often, immediately. He said, the missing link is my boot in their face. Prabhupada was a provocative person. Prabhupada was never really accurately presented with evidence for evolution. But his point was that, you know, scientists are drawing conclusion based on a very, very, very small subset of knowledge, or a very, very small subset of reality. So within that small subset, they can come to reasonable conclusions, but they're leaving out, you know, 99.9% of the picture. So what does that mean? That basically means that intelligent people take knowledge on faith, actually. We're all taking knowledge on faith. Most of the things that we know is because somebody told us. You know, we go to the university, you know, we read something in a book, we hear a lecture, we regurgitate that information on a test, and we say we know it. I got a 95 on my test. I know this stuff really well. But you don't really know it. You believe it because somebody told you. You know, and you're kind of forced to believe it because if you don't get a good grade, you're probably not going to get a job. Most people graduating from college these days are probably not going to get a job anyway. Sorry for the cynicism. Oh, especially if you're, anyway. So what is knowledge? To obtain knowledge, we need to hear from somebody who has attained knowledge. And Krishna explains what knowledge is in the Bhagavad Gita. This is Bhagavad Gita 13:8-12. Humility, pridelessness, nonviolence, tolerance, simplicity, approaching a bona fide spiritual master, cleanliness, steadiness, self-control, renunciation of the objects of sense gratification, absence of false ego, the perception of the evil of birth, death, old age, and disease, detachment, freedom from entanglement with children, wife, home, and the rest, even-mindedness amid pleasant and unpleasant events, constant and unalloyed devotion to me, not me, Krishna, aspiring to live in a solitary place, detachment from the general mass of people, accepting the importance of self-realization, and philosophical search for the absolute truth. All this I declare to be knowledge. And besides this, whatever there is ignorance. So here we see that Krishna explains knowledge in a completely different way as what we accept as knowledge, for example, from the university. In the university or in modern academia or whatever, knowledge is like a set of facts. It's a set of facts that define our worldview. Here we see Krishna is presenting knowledge as something different, and this kind of addresses what you were saying, Mother, about the gnosis. Here Krishna is describing knowledge as not a set of facts or a set of so-called truths. He's describing knowledge as a set of qualities. You know, that knowledge is manifested by the personal qualities of the person who is in knowledge. So if somebody is humble, that is a sign that somebody knows something. It seems a little contradictory. You know, a lot of people, often we have a vision of false humility. Oh, I am so useless. This is not really humility, this is just low self-esteem. Humility is actually a symptom of knowledge. Somebody who is in knowledge is humble. Pridelessness, nonviolence. So Krishna describes knowledge as actually a set of qualities. And so if we want to know something, through my coercive powers of rhetorical persuasion, I've now convince you all that if you really want to know something, you need to hear from a bona fide source. And here Krishna is explaining who the bona fide source is. Krishna is describing the person who is in knowledge. And the person who is in knowledge is the person who is possessed of these qualities. And so to bring this to a conclusion and to open up to questions, I just want to say that we have faith in Srila Prabhupada as a Mahabhagavat, not only because the words in Prabhupada's books ring true to us. You know, we've all heard this philosophy and we go, yeah, that makes an awful lot of sense. You know, you could go into Prabhupada's books and find some things that go and say, wait a minute, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You know, like Prabhupada in the Bhagavatam explains that the moon is further away from the earth than the sun is. Well, it's a little hard to grasp with our logic, reason, and argument. And as I said before, it's not that everything in the absolute truth has to be reasonable and logical. The real reason, at least I can speak personally, the real reason why I have faith in Srila Prabhupada's words is not blind faith, in my opinion, is because Prabhupada has these qualities. You know, and these are the qualities of somebody who is free from material contamination. Now, and we know from reading the Bhagavad Gita and we know from the Bhagavatam that we are not these bodies. And the original pure state of the living entity is to be engaged in a loving relationship with Krishna. And that relationship involves direct perception of Krishna as a person and direct perception of Krishna's personal qualities. And this perception is available to anybody who becomes free from the contamination of material life. And this is basically what Prabhupada is explaining here, that when you become free, these are the symptoms of someone who is not entangled in material existence. And when we develop these qualities, we can also attain direct perception of Krishna. And in that state, we can claim to know Krishna, like Prabhupada knew Krishna. There's a story where in the early days of ISKCON, Prabhupada was commissioning an awful lot of artwork for his books. He thought this was a very important part of his preaching, to have beautiful artwork of Krishna. And in the beginning, in 22nd Avenue, the devotees, you know, Prabhupada was describing Krishna, and Prabhupada realized that these devotees, these young people that had, they had no idea what Krishna looked like, actually. Whereas in India, you know, you go to India, there's, you know, cartoony pictures of Krishna everywhere. Everybody knows what Krishna looks like. So Prabhupada commissioned all this artwork, and we see that artwork is actually such an integral part of our preaching. So many people buy our books, because they love the pictures in our books. And so one time, you know, they commissioned, there's this one picture of Krishna, a very elegant picture where he's got these big lotus eyes and there's a deer, I think, on his lap. And Prabhupada saw this picture and he said, that looks the most like Krishna. Yeah. And so Prabhupada knew Krishna directly. There's another story where, Prabhupada used to sit on a bench in some park in New York City before he attracted a lot of followers, and he would just sit on this bench chanting and waiting, basically. And there was an old man who used to come and sit with Prabhupada that somehow got interviewed for the Prabhupada Lilamrita. And he said that Prabhupada always seemed to be alone, but when he spoke as if he was not alone. He was always in the presence of somebody else, at least in his own mind. And he was always in the presence of Krishna because Prabhupada had these qualities. So when we just accept, so just to accept Prabhupada as an authority is not necessarily blind faith. You know, there's a reason why we have faith in Prabhupada, and that's because Prabhupada manifested, of course, also profound erudition and scholasticism, profound knowledge of the Vedas, so much so that he was uniquely empowered by our entire Guru Parampara to translate this eternal knowledge into a language for mlechas, basically. Prabhupada said that English is a language for horses. You know, so, you know. And so Prabhupada had the unique gift to take the writings of the Goswamis and the commentary of Jiva Goswami and Sridhar Swami and Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur and put this in a language that we could all understand. But the real potency of Srila Prabhupada's preaching came not from his knowledge, it came from his bhakti. And so if we want to obtain knowledge, we should take, as the verse we read said, we should take shelter of the bona fide spiritual master and hear submissively from him. And this in and of itself is an act of love, and which is bhakti, and in and of itself leads to purification of the senses, by which we then don't have to believe, you know, then our knowledge comes out of the realm of belief and it comes into real knowledge. Which, you know, Krishna explains as pratyaksha vargamam damyam. It's joyfully, susukam kartum avyayam. It's joyfully performed, and it's available by direct perception. God bless you. So I guess I'll stop there before the prasadam train rolls in and ask if there are any questions. Hope I didn't confuse you. Yeah.
Question is, what's wrong with horses?
Yeah. I just briefly wanted to comment about Prabhupada's statement that the sun is closer than the moon.
Yeah.
So just for those who haven't understood this, imagine you're in Manhattan. You have to see Mr. Smith and Mr. Jones. And you're standing in front of Mr. Smith's office building on First Street. And Mr. Jones is on Second Street. Well, who's closer, Mr. Smith or Mr. Jones? Well, actually, Mr. Jones may be closer if Mr. Smith is on the top floor of a 100-story skyscraper, whereas Mr. Jones is just a block away. Okay, so the point is there are multi-dimensions in considering proximity of the planets, and based on that, Prabhupada said the moon is closer than the sun is closer than the moon.
Yeah, don't want to confuse anybody. Thank you. That was very nice. Yeah.
So sometimes we meet students and they say, yes, they say that we take the knowledge from the scientists, but the scientists are using processes of logic and perception, and that they are doing the groundwork.
Yeah.
So what's wrong if we take it from the scientists and we totally believe in them?
The problem is, as I presented with this Grand Canyon issue, is that even what we were able to perceive as scientists, and I'm a scientist myself, it's just an extremely small subset of reality. For example, like the dating of these rocks, like how do we know that this Vishnu schist is 1.8, billion years old? Well, they use something called a mass spectrometer, which is able to measure very, very, very small changes in uranium isotopes, So based on the ratio of uranium isotopes in a rock, you can extract a date, an age from it. And there's a lot of math involved. So that's faith also. You need to have faith in the math that's involved. So it's not, so immediately it's in the realm of faith. But then the other thing, when I give this seminar in a longer period, I take a few minutes to explain how a mass spectrometer works. And at which point everybody who's listening to me is like, huh? And that's exactly the point. Like, there's so many things that can go wrong in the operation of a mass spectrometer. And just in the construction and the whole theory behind it, it's like, really? Okay, it's based on so many assumptions. The primary assumption is that, so this uranium isotope has a decay rate of 4 billion years. So if you have if we were to put a lump of uranium here on the table, we're not going to do that. In 4 billion years, half of that lump would be gone. It would just decay away. And so one of the fundamental assumptions based on here is that that decay rate has not changed in the last 4 billion years. And there's really, and I ask scientists that I work with all the time, this is always my challenge, well, how do you know that hasn't changed? And they go, well, we haven't seen it change in the last 100 years, so. So obviously, Okay, great. So even the principles that we accept as science, and in our secular world that we live in, we were basically all brainwashed by scientists, which is why Prabhupada was very much preaching against these people. This is so much based on faith and so much based on inference but they don't tell you that. We always talk about scientific proof, but actually according to the real philosophy of science, science doesn't prove anything. A good scientist knows that you can never prove anything with science. You can only prove something is false. This is the principle of falsifiability. So we accept something as true until somebody can come along and prove that it's false. But this is, not proof of anything. And so ultimately the theories, our scientific theories, people believe these things. This is not knowledge, this is belief. And it's very important to make this distinction. Yes, we'll get to you so we can get back in the kitchen. Yeah.
I have a question there. Yeah. Sariputta's books, he's talking about how, forbidden archaeology specifically, he's talking about how there's been many archaeological finds over the years that have been completely kept out of view of the public.
Yeah.
That, for instance, Table Mountain comes to mind in California, where they had an entire museum of artifacts buried under, I think it was 1.5 million years of sediment of rock with no cracks so it could fall through.
Yeah.
Lots of stuff. And the Smithsonian Institution came in and took all that, and it vanished. And they said, we don't know what happened to it, but it proved the antiquity of mankind. So
It did not prove the antiquity of mankind. It presented evidence that mankind might be older than we think it is.
Didn't it prove it?
I don't know the details of that particular find, but one piece of evidence.
Yeah, they found plates and cups and forks. I mean, very, very advanced, artifacts, which were buried under completely solid rock.
Yeah, but you don't know that. You know that because you read that in a book and you happen to have faith in the source of that
book. There's archaeologists who did a whole find on it, and they wrote it in many of their papers that was what they found.
Yeah.
It wasn't just one or two people. It was a sensation in California. It was a big, big find.
Okay.
So, whether that's proof or not, it's proof to me.
All right.
I guess my question is that the scientists, even if they're presented with some evidence, and if that evidence contradicts what they want the general mass of people to understand, they'll just push it aside like it's not. I think you call it a knowledge filter.
Yeah, there's science and there's scientism, which is also a religion, in which case, you know, it's just dogmatic. We're just going to believe what we want to believe that fits into our worldview, and if you have evidence of something that doesn't fit into our worldview,
they brush it aside.
It can get suppressed, yeah.
Okay.
For sure. In the back there, Andy and Jesper. Here comes the Prashadam train.
I just want to say that I know a lot of scholars respond to and say that what you're saying about Prabhupada is hagiography. How do we know that he's really self-realized, as you say he is? You know, so what would your response be to that?
What is my response to when people ask how I know Prabhupada?
Yeah, scholars would say that your information could be just based on hagiography of a religious.
Yeah, well, that's why the title of my thing is Leaps of Faith and Doubt. I mean, some people are just going to take a position of skepticism no matter what evidence you present them with, and that's a leap of doubt. I think you can look fairly objectively at Prabhupada's life and see that this man was pure. I mean, Prabhupada was free from the four pillars of sinful activities from the time that he was born. You know, there's a story... I'll just narrate this while the Prashadam comes out. There's a story. Devotees were preaching in a town in India, Surat, and they were holding. Prabhupada was staying with a life member there in Surat, and he was a little ill, so he was mostly just staying in the house. And devotees were going out and making Harinam every day in the city, and they were organizing a pandal program for Prabhupada at the end of the week. And as the week went on, more and more people started participating. More and more just local residents of this city of Surat, which I guess in India is a village, but would be the largest city in America. I don't know. And as the week went on, more and more people were participating in this Harinam until the point where, the whole city shut down on the last couple of days. Just like everything in the city stopped and everybody in the city was going out on Harinam with Prabhupada's disciples. And so Prabhupada heard about this and thought, well, I'm not going to sit around sick here in this life member's house if there's this huge ecstatic Harinam going on. And so he went out on the Harinam with them one day at the end of the week. And after a while, he had to come back. He was feeling tired. And so he came back. And when he got back to the life member's house, there was just like a throng of people. Like he couldn't get out of the car. And he needed to get some of his larger-bodied disciples to clear a path for him so he wouldn't basically get trampled by people wanting to touch his feet or get his blessings or whatever. And they cleared a path and he made it to the front door of the life member's house. And he turned around and he said to his disciples, "Do you know why these people are worshiping me like this?" And his disciples, I don't know what they responded, but he left a pregnant pause for dramatic effect. And he said, "They're worshiping me because I'm free from sex life." And so this is, the point is that you have to have faith. Prabhupada writes this in the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, that if you want to understand the Bhagavad Gita, you need to at least theoretically accept Krishna as God. So there needs to be a little bit of faith. And in the beginning, that faith can be like an experiment, like, okay, I'm just going to see what happens if I accept this. And you can perform an experiment. I tell this to people. You know, you don't need to believe me that following four regular principles is a good idea. You can try it yourself and see what happens. You know, but in order to take that step, to make that jump, okay, I'm going to give up, you know, meat, fish and eggs, et cetera, you need to maybe believe that this might work. So in the beginning, there has to be faith, and maybe in the beginning, that faith is blind, but it doesn't stay blind for very long. You know, any of these people who live in our area, if they were to follow four regular principles for a week, they would notice the quality of their life changing dramatically. Yeah. Just giving up hamburgers, you know, even on a material platform will change the quality of your life dramatically. You know, what to speak of celibacy. Oh my God. What a revolutionary concept. Yeah. Okay. So I guess.